From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Housing prices are going through the roof across the country. 34 states have reported increases over a year ago, with red-hot markets from San Diego to Boston jumping more than 20%. From Rhode Island to Illinois to Nevada and California, home prices keep soaring. Nobody seems to know how long this real estate feeding frenzy can last, and the uncertainty is fueling fears there's a bubble out there waiting to burst. In this hour, a real estate reality check. We begin in Los Angeles with a look at one of the driving forces behind rising home prices, historically low interest rates. Right now, you can get a 30-year fixed-rate mortgage at an interest rate of just over 6%. There's been a refinancing stampede on banks. Scott Record is banking reporter for the Los Angeles Times, and he's tracked this summer's mortgage mania. I asked him to put the current round of mortgage activity in perspective.
Oh, it's huge, and what's amazing is that it's so unexpected. The mortgage market last year topped $2 trillion nationwide.
That is in refinanced mortgages, is that right, or all mortgages?
About half of that was refinanced. Of course, the housing markets are booming, too, as you know, in places like Boston, where the prices have gone up just like they have here in Southern California. But about half of it, and what people thought was that that would drop off significantly, that we'd maybe get about half as many refinancings this year as last year. What we're seeing is that it's running at the same pace or ahead, because the rates are just down so low. And so, you know, we've got the mortgage processors swamped, and we've got some people doing what I call serial refinancings.
You know, they
got
What do you mean by that, Scott?
Well, a lot of these new refinancings, you know, you don't pay any points, or in some cases you don't pay any cost at all. All the fees are picked up by the lender. What that means is, unless you have a prepayment penalty, a lot of them don't, however, you don't really have anything in it. So let's say, you know, in the old days, you know, there are all these talks about if you're going to have the mortgage for X long,
it needs to be down by 2 points or half a point.
It needs to be down by 2 points, a half a point or something. It doesn't really matter. I mean, if you can shave a quarter point or a half a point off, it didn't cost you anything for the last loan 6 months ago.
So people might refinance and then turn right around a couple months later and refinance again.
That's what we were writing about today. And you know, the variety of different loan products has a lot to do with that, too. But we are seeing people refinance over and over again.
So $2 trillion in mortgages last year, and we may top that again this year.
Yeah, it could get to $2.2 trillion, maybe $2.3 trillion this year.
What does that mean for the economy, Scott Record?
It tends to be good for the economy. You know, if we just look at the refinancings, what you're doing is getting your payment down. If you keep the amount the same and you get the payment down, you'll have more money in your pocket that you can spend. Your mortgage isn't as big. The other thing, of course, that happens, and this is one of the things that the Fed wanted to happen to stimulate the economy, is that a lot of people take cash out in a refinance, and then they go out and do home improvements or spend it on something else. So that's very good for the economy. And, of course, when you buy a new house, you buy new furnishings. So all of these mortgage things have a ripple effect on spending in the economy.
And what about the impact on the housing market itself of all this very easy credit? You quote someone today saying, what is it, if you can breathe, you can get a loan.
It's obviously been very good for the housing market. It's also contributed to some talk that we may be in a bubble in certain expensive areas. And I think, obviously, if the rates went back up again sharply, in a lot of these places, you just would no longer have nearly as many people who'd be able to buy the houses.
Which could mean that a reversal of the direction of rates could set off a decline in housing prices?
It's possible. I think probably what you'd need, there's still an awfully strong demand and a big shortage. When we had sort of the last recession that was especially bad out here in California, one of the things that had happened was that there had been a lot of building. So there was kind of an overhang, particularly of expensive homes that didn't sell. It's just not the case today in most markets. There really is an undersupply of housing. But having said that, if you had a bad economic setback, something like a lot more layoffs, a lot more unemployment that rippled through the economy, particularly if rates went back up a little bit, I think that it could have a real effect, and particularly in the more expensive markets that have gone up the most.
You write that we're looking at the lowest rates since 1966. How low are rates today for 30-year, 15-year fixed mortgages?
Well, they are in the 6% range. It depends on how many points you're willing to pay. I think if you average them all out, including the jumbo loans, the really big loans where you have to pay more than $300,000 that a lot of people are having to take on to buy houses in expensive markets like Boston and Southern California, the figure I saw was about 6.3% on average. And
for a 30-year fixed.
This is 30-year fixed. Yeah, you get it for 30 years fixed. Now, if another thing that's out there are these hybrid products. So if you're willing to go over and say, look, I'll take it fixed for 5 years or 7 years, you can get that down a lot more. Somebody today with very good credit was telling me someone had offered them a fixed rate loan for 7 years. It adjusts after that, but for 7 years, fixed, no points, at 5.8%. So people are getting money for remarkably
That's
low rates.
That's incredible. So people on that kind of schedule are looking at actually paying off their mortgage at these low rates.
Well, again, your payment is over 30 years on this thing, so you can always pay more. And that's another thing we're seeing is people are going into shorter-term loans, particularly baby boomers looking ahead to retirement. Maybe the stock portfolio is down, and they're saying, hey, you know, I got to get this house paid off just like the folks did because, you know, that's how I'm going to retire.
That's security.
That is security. And so you look at it, and on a, you know, you might be able to go out and get a 15-year mortgage at, I don't know, 5.5% or something, possibly by paying a point or two. That may not be a bad alternative for a lot of people.
There was a whole wave of baby boomers who had to look at high teens of, in percentage when they first bought homes. Was it the early 80s we were looking at mortgages at 16, 17, even 18%?
I think they got as high as that. I certainly remember that. The first house I bought was in 83, and we had a 12% mortgage on it. That's twice what people are paying now. So it really is an astonishing turnaround, and that has made homes all that more affordable. Again, you can see the effect of that on keeping the home prices going up.
What does the road ahead look like?
Well, for the immediate future, you've got the signs are that rates aren't going to go up anytime soon, certainly not by the end of the year. In fact, a lot of people think the Fed will cut its rates, which tend to help keep mortgage rates low by the end of the year. Now, some of that may already be factored in these very low rates, but it's unlikely in the near future that they will go back up sharply. What's out there a year ahead, your guess is probably as good as mine.
Scott Record, thanks very much for joining us.
Glad to be there. Thanks, Tom.
Scott Record covers the banking industry for the Los Angeles Times. We're digging in tonight for a hard look at what's going on with home prices. In much of the country, prices are climbing through the stratosphere, and that's fueling fears of a bubble that could burst. With Wall Street down, the economy on shaky ground, and lingering memories of the dot-com bust, all eyes are on the health of the real estate market. Do we have an unsustainable bubble here? Have you tried to buy a home lately? Are you counting on your home equity as a retirement nest egg? Do we risk a housing market meltdown? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining us now from New York City is Ian Morris, Chief U.S. Economist at HSBC Securities in New York. Good evening and welcome, Ian Morris.
Thank you very much.
It's good to have you. And from the studios of Vermont Public Radio, On Point News analyst Jack Beatty, senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly magazine. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom.
Ian Morris, you are not so confident that this great run-up in home prices can be sustained. In fact, you are a believer that there is a bubble out there.
Yes, I think it is an unsustainable position, and my fear is that when the housing market does tip over, and that may be in the next 6 to 12 months, the result may be quite a hard landing as opposed to, you know, a soft landing. And I think it's worthwhile noting that we learned over the past 18 months that a business cycle still exists. We went through the pain of the recession last year, and it kind of woke a lot of people up from the euphoria of the NASDAQ bubble. And sure, we may have better productivity in the economy, but cycles still exist.
What does that mean in the housing market? We'll talk about the landing in a moment, but what's the evidence in your review of the facts that suggests there's a real estate bubble?
Well, again, you know, cycles go up and down, and the home cycle is now running very hot and booming away, and people are forgetting that housing can go down as well as up. And historically, it's been the most cyclically sensitive part of the economy. And so it's ludicrous to think that there is no cycle left over. Now, in terms of prices, one of the measures we can look at to see whether it's overvalued or not is to compare aggregate house values across the nation relative to disposable income.
Mm-hmm.
So you kind of have a P.E. ratio, or what's called a price-to-earnings ratio that we use for stocks.
Almost an equivalent of the way you would assess a stock.
Exactly, mm-hmm. But kind of for the housing market.
Okay, so income versus housing prices, and what do you see?
Well, on this basis, and I'm using the Federal Reserve's data, which is considered to be the best, it's at its record high that the value of real estate on the consumer's balance sheet relative to disposable income is at its richest since the history of this series began in 1950. And in fact, the last time it was nearly this high was in late 1989, which, of course, was the peak of the property bubble back then.
Ian Morse, how does this play out geographically? We know that along all the coasts and in major cities in the Midwest, we've seen big price increases. But is the whole country seeing this phenomenon, or is it something that's that you would pin on major metropolitan areas?
Well, nationwide, if you look at averages, it is getting kind of toppy, about as toppy, not quite, but about as toppy as it was getting in the late 1980s. But it's particularly intensive in the top end of town. They are, even though they've come down in price a bit, they are still vulnerable. And in terms of regions, a collections of states clustered in the Pacific, Mountain, and North Central regions can now be probably considered bubbles. So California as a whole, particularly places like San Francisco and San Jose. And the worrying news is that the recent price surges over the past year suggest that more and more of the Northeast is now coming into that kind of territory as well.
Jack Beatty, an awful lot of people who have seen their 401k accounts, their stock holdings shrink and shrivel, are counting on their home to carry value in the years ahead, particularly toward retirement.
Yeah, just when you thought it was safe to come in from the water, here comes another shark.
Mm-hmm.
You know, on the stocks, the top 1% of Americans own half of all stocks. The bottom 80% own just 4%. Most Americans have their wealth in a house.
Mm-hmm.
And anything that shakes it is profoundly shaking to their whole future, to what they expect. But, you know, even if you get a little bit off from the coast, I'm up here, I don't know, 150 miles from Boston. I'm looking at an ad. Beautiful open fields, faraway views, 63 acres, 4 bedrooms, 4 baths, wood floors. Price for this beautiful-looking house? $269,000.
Oh, they're going to be knocking on your door tomorrow morning, Jack, to learn where that is.
Not bad. Grafton, Vermont, charming country Victorian, 3 acres, blah, 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 $165,000. Not bad up here. And, you know, I spent an hour looking through the web. You go to Cedar Rapids, Iowa for $184,000, 4 beds, 4 baths, 2-car garage. Nevada, Missouri, 3 bedrooms, $84,000. You go to Albany, New York, you can get yourself a townhouse a la Beacon Hill, fireplaces, the whole works, $275,000.
Jack, are you suggesting people are going to be fleeing the city, the big cities for, you know, next-tier towns where they can have a lot of square footage?
I guess I'm saying that the geography of this really does have to be specified. Obviously, as soon as you come within the ambit of the city, moving across the country, rates go up. But in much of the country, what's called the real estate burden, that nexus between income and price, is around, I mean, in most of the Midwest, it's like 10%, whereas here in the East, it's close to 30%. So I'm I think there are these problems, but if you just go slightly in from the coast here and also elsewhere. By the way, in Crawford, Texas, 2-bedroom house, $46,000.
Move in next to the Bushes.
Yeah, they'd love you.
Ian Morse, what about it? If it's a dappled picture across the country, if it's not the same bubble, if indeed it's a bubble everywhere, does that make a difference in what the impact on the nation would be if there's a bubble and it bursts?
Well, it depends where the bubbles are, and unfortunately it is in those areas which produce most of the economy's output. And it is in those hot areas, if they were to go under, that are likely to lead the way down. Now, I take the point that some areas, you know, outside the major cities might appear cheap, but we're talking about nationwide house prices still growing by 7 to 8%. At a time when inflation is running at 2% or lower.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, let's spread out what's going on, and let's take an average. And even what we're seeing there is unsustainable.
Ian Morse, stand by. We've got to take a short break. We're talking tonight about sky-high housing prices. Are we in a bubble? Have you tried to buy a home lately? What do you think your home is worth? What do you think it'll be worth a year from now? Are we nearing a housing bomb to follow the dot bomb? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about sky-high American housing prices and asking, are we in a bubble? Are you in the housing market? Have you been shopping for a home? What are you seeing out there? Real estate agents, are you seeing buyer resistance to super high home prices? Are you counting on a real estate nest egg to finance your retirement? Are you confident your home will hold its value? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We're joined tonight by Ian Morris. He's chief U.S. economist for HSBC Securities in New York. Ian Morris, you talked before about the fear of a hard landing as opposed to a soft landing. This presumes that there's a bubble and that, as you suggest, perhaps within a year it's going to burst. You predict a hard landing. What does that mean in terms of home prices?
Well, in many of the hot areas that we were discussing earlier, given that many of these places have doubled in price over the past 5 or 6 years, you could easily get double-digit declines in the order of 10 to 20% maybe. Now, nationwide, it's not likely to be that bad. In fact, the nationwide average, prices rarely decline, but in the last recession, for example, they did fall for 2 or 3 quarters. So I think something similar could happen across the country, but it will be particularly severe in certain regions and downtown locations.
Is a 10 to 20% decline in home prices a calamity? There may be some buyers who welcome it. Is this a catastrophe for the economy?
Part of the quirk regarding housing markets actually is that if you have a house and you bought it and you want to sell it at some point, but the market is down, so you can only get a lower price than what you paid for, many people have a problem with that, and they don't like doing it. There's a psychological barrier about wanting to sell your home at a lower price than what you paid for it. So one of the strange things that happens in housing markets is that people just take the house off the market. So there's a complete drying up of transactions that goes on.
That would seem to be something that would then drive prices up again, wouldn't it?
It won't drive it up because there's always some transactions going on and prices will come down, but it limits the downside to some extent. But the point I want to make is that if the market cannot clear fully on price, it will clear in terms of the volume of transactions. And that's why typically existing home sales and new home sales will collapse 20 or 30%.
People just won't be willing to sell their home if they can't get a price they consider reasonable.
Exactly. And that constrains the ability of consumers. It constrains your ability to go out and improve your home. You cut back on your spending elsewhere. You basically hunker down, and confidence can actually be quite vulnerable in that situation.
Is that the bursting bubble that economists talk about being a threat to the economy at large?
Well, it is, simply because, as what was mentioned earlier, most people have their wealth in housing. Now, what we saw in the early 1990s was actually quite bad, because at the end of the 80s, housing markets fell, and real house prices, and what I mean there, inflation-adjusted house prices, fell for 5 years. That is, house prices was either falling or growing lower than inflation. And that went on for 5 years, and it explained the sogginess of the economic recovery in the early 1990s. And I suspect something similar could happen for 2 or 3 years when this thing finally tips over. And I tell you, a lot of it has to do with the stock market, because there's so many case studies around the world where the property market peaks 2 or 3 years after the peak in equity markets.
So we would be approaching that point now.
We're kind of in that time frame. And what's kind of weird is that initially, for the first 2 or 3 years after a stock market crash, the stock market crash itself can trigger the house price rises.
Because people run to the real estate market.
Exactly. What happens is that households are raising their preference for the perceived safety of houses over stocks. So that lifts the demand for mortgages. Meanwhile, because the stock market crash is weakening the economy and sending it into recession, the Fed is cutting interest rates aggressively, so mortgage rates are helped along going down, and that also increases the demand for mortgages. But I tell you what, something else is going on. Because the stocks crash, household balance sheets deteriorate, and as households shift their money from stocks to bank accounts, it also lifts deposits in the banking system. And banks, in this kind of recession, they don't want to lend to the commercial sector. So what they want to do instead to try and raise their earnings is actually lift their lending to the consumer.
And that's mortgage lending.
Supply mortgages actually goes up as well.
Jack Beatty, here's something. As you say, a lot of people invest in their home, and yet with these super high price rises, there's a have and have not dynamic going on there too. And another circumstance where we're being told in some sense the economy is dependent on keeping things supercharged.
Yeah, but you know, look where it's heading. I mean, 47% of African Americans own homes. That's up from about 40% a decade ago. 71% of whites own homes. But that means that 50% of African Americans and 30% of white Americans don't own a home. Now, how, if they live near any metropolitan area from a standing start, can you jump in, say, in Boston, to the housing market where the median price is $360,000? I mean, you know, there are only so many, we used to say there are only so many lawyer and doctor couples, but this is getting to the point where there are only so many entrepreneur couples. I mean, who could, you know, how can you come up with that kind of savings for a down payment? On the other hand, one of the ways people are coming up with it, and I think I want to hear Ian's reaction to this, is I've heard an economist tell me that Fannie Mae is actually, which is the mortgage brokerage institution, is actually feeding a bubble by making mortgages available to more and more economically vulnerable people. On the one hand, that's good. We want everybody in the market. But it says that on any sort of shaking, Fannie Mae may have given a lot of mortgages out there to people who are not going to be able to make the payments. Is there a feeling that this institution is playing a kind of baneful role in this bubble?
How about it, Ian Morris? Is Fannie Mae fanning the flames?
Well, Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, they're there. They have a social charter. They're there to help help progress the economy in terms of widening home ownership. And I think over the long run, they've done a pretty good job in that respect. But the secondary mortgage market, which is what you're talking about, sort of bundling up home loans that banks make and then dropping it into the secondary market, whether via Fannie Mae or someone else, and forwarding on those loans to other investors, certainly that there is the potential for a kind of feeding frenzy to occur, because right now banks have every incentive to make a home loan and have no intention of keeping it on their books as an asset. What they'll do is earn fees by forwarding it on to the secondary market and hopefully selling it off to someone else. So in that kind of environment, I don't know if it's happening or not, but it's conceivable that kind of circular game picks up to try, you know, where you make the loan and then you forward it on to
pass it on to Fannie Mae or whoever. Ian Morris, Jack, stand by. Margaret's on the line. Welcome, Margaret. You're on the air.
Hello.
Hi.
Thanks for taking my call.
Good to have you.
I live about an hour south of Boston.
Okay.
And I just bought and sold a home. Well, I'm about to close on both of them. The house that I sold, I just sold for $100,000 more than I bought it 2 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And the house that I bought is in the same town and the same price about that I bought this original house. But it's much smaller. It's half a duplex as opposed to a, you know, and it's on a very small plot of land.
So you're hanging on to the $100,000 that you made, Margaret. Why?
Well, actually, that was a divorce, so I only got half of that.
Okay, well, 50. But are you happy to be pocketing some of that run-up in equity that you sold?
I'm not I'm not really pocketing it because I'm putting it into this other house. Mm-hmm. My concern being I got a good mortgage rate. I got 5.5% for 5 years. But if this is, in fact, a bubble, when I go to sell this little house that I'm living in, that I'm planning to move into, I mean, I don't want to live there too long.
So when Ian Morris talks about people being stuck in their homes for 2, 3, 4, 5 years that they may not want, that doesn't sound so great to you.
No, not at all. So then when I go to sell it, am I going to get nothing for it? And the other question I had is that I locked in at 5.5 probably maybe 3 weeks ago.
Mm-hmm.
And now I'm wondering if I should have locked in.
Because the rates have gone down even further. Ian Morris, here's the classic clammy forehead when someone buys a new home in a toppy market. Margaret's concerned, you know, is she going to see the value of the house she just bought drop, and should she be holding out for even a lower interest rate?
Well, these are good questions, and the problem is that as human beings, we all have to live somewhere, right?
Yes, we do.
We need a roof over our heads. And from that point of view, even if the market is hot, you've got to consider even purchasing in such a scenario. But I think, you know, the key thing to do here is to make sure that you're prepared to buy a place that you want to live in for some period of time, say 5 years or so, because it can't be guaranteed that in 2 years you will actually see home price appreciation. In fact, it may come back a little bit. Now, hopefully, you know, it won't be more than a 10 to 20% decline.
Mm-hmm.
But after, you know, running up 100% over 2 or 3 or 5 years, some pullback might be in store.
So it's just not a good time to be hopping from one home to another if the market's toppy. What about Margaret's question on the interest rate? I think she said she got about 5.5%. That doesn't sound too bad.
I mean 5.5%. I think, you know, is quite good. And the thing that's going on here, the reason why, you know, there is this short term potential for it to go even lower is because of the mess that corporate America is in. Basically, the bigger the corporate pain, the bigger is housing's gain right now.
Mm-hmm.
Because the more the stock market gets hit, the more interest rates come down, and therefore the lower mortgage rates are. So to bet on lower mortgage rates, you really have to bet on the economy worsening.
Against the
economy. Now, if that happens, even though mortgage rates might go lower, it might not be good for home values because a worsening economy implies a higher unemployment rate.
Mm-hmm.
Already the unemployment rates shoot it up from 4 to 6%,
mm-hmm.
and some economists are talking about a double dip. I'm not that bearish on the economy, but if the unemployment rate were to move up again to, say, 8%, even if mortgage rates were to come down, possibly the income losses generated from higher unemployment will hurt housing prices.
So wait for a lower interest rate, and you may find you don't even have a job to buy anything. Ian Morris, stand by. And Jack Beattie, I want to welcome into our conversation now David Luray. He's chief economist at the National Association of Realtors. Good evening and welcome, David Luray.
Well, thank you very much. I tell you, I've been listening for just a couple of minutes, and my ears are burning and my eyebrows are raised.
Okay, well, give us your view. Ian Morris is talking about a hard landing in the housing market. He says, yes, there's a bubble, not absolutely everywhere, but in many parts of the country. He sees a hard landing very likely within the next year. What's your view?
Well, I think Ian's a little misguided on this, and to throw out numbers like we're going to experience a 10 or 20% drop in home prices, that's basically creating hysteria, pushing almost a self-fulfilling prophecy.
Well, but you know, David, there were a lot of investors in the stock market who 2 years ago would have been grateful to have that kind of heads up on what happened there. I think people are looking for
I think
advice.
There's a big difference here, and the problem is, and the Wall Street Journal did this too, everyone's trying to equate the stock market with the real estate market. And if the stock market has a bubble and the bubble bursts, then it must be that real estate is next.
Once bitten, twice shy, I guess, is the dynamic there. But what is your view of where we're headed?
Well, I think the reality is that in the stock market, you had, as Alan Greenspan, chairman of the Fed, said, irrational exuberance. You had P.E. ratios going from 30 to almost 300, 400. So you did have irrational buying out there, not based on pure expectations of an earnings stream. In the housing market, there is no national price bubble. That's the first thing. So let's not push that hysteria.
Give us the rationale for saying there's not a bubble. We're looking at these prices that are going up very fast. Ian Morris has described to us how the ratio of aggregate income to housing prices has never been more stretched.
That's not true. But let's start with national prices. I have the data. We're the ones that put out the data. And in the first quarter, home prices were at 8.1% price appreciation. In the second quarter, they actually went down to 7.4%.
Nationally.
Mm-hmm. Nationally. So nationally, we have no bubble. If anything, if you want to call it a bubble, the bubble may deflate somewhat where will go from an 8% or 7% price appreciation down to the 6% range and maybe even down to 4 or 5%, which is what the historic norm usually is.
So what's the significance then if we have a pattern of smaller bubbles around the country, or do you even see that?
I see very few of them. Out of the 100 metro markets that we survey, 75 of those markets have experienced only single-digit gains. You know, so three-quarters of the entire country is only experiencing single-digit gains, and that's normal. There's nothing unusual about that.
Ian Morse, mix it up a little bit here. David LeRae just doesn't see it, not even very much at the individual market level.
Well, no, let's not say that. Now, Ian is right. There are some individual markets that have experienced 20% gains. Even the Boston area, I think, just went over double-digit, maybe 10 or 11%. But the Long Island, New York area, and the Bergen County area, New Jersey, they're 25, almost 30% gains. Mm-hmm. And you do worry about the Northern California area as well. There's some local areas around the country that have experienced very, very strong price appreciation. But I think you need to understand the fundamentals behind it before you go off and saying, well, if it increased 20%, and over 5 years it increased maybe 100% or 80%, It must be that you're going to have a 20% drop at some point.
Ian Morse, are you peddling hysteria?
Well, for a start, you know, I think as economists, both David and I know that, you know, just because something goes up, it doesn't necessarily go down. And when I suggested that some prices will go down 10 to 20%, I am talking about those hot areas.
Mm-hmm.
And what I think we all acknowledge is that the Fed's data is probably the best data, and for what it's worth, the Federal Reserve's flow of funds data suggests to us that the value of real estate relative to income is at an extremely high level, and even higher than it was in 1989.
Mm-hmm. David LeRae,
even though nationwide house prices doesn't decline for a long period of time, maybe only small amounts for 2 or 3 quarters, house prices did lag inflation for 5 years in the early 90s. Mm-hmm. And that is a potent negative wealth effect for consumption if it should ever tip over.
David LeRae, we've only got you for a little bit longer. What's your prospect looking out here? Talk to homeowners. They're all ears.
Well, first, let me say that he mentioned the Fed. Well, it's Alan Greenspan himself that said there is no bubble in real estate. And he said that very recently. Second, when you talk about the median price as a percentage of the median income, and he likes to bring that up as well. Right now, the ratio is about 2.9. That's in the historic range of 2.5 to 3. But the reality is that median price to the median income ratio is not the real relevant ratio you should be looking at. The reason is that it's historically low mortgage rates that are bringing demand out into the home buying process. When you look at the mortgage payment as a percentage of the income, that has dropped significantly, so that the fundamentals right now in housing are such that it's very, very difficult to concoct a scenario where even if demand falls off a bit, you can have a big drop in prices.
David LeRae, we've got to take a break. Thanks for joining us, Chief Economist at the National Association of Realtors. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about sky-high housing prices and asking, are we in a housing bubble? Are America's soaring home prices sustainable? Can you believe what homes are selling for and who's buying at these prices? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Jack Beatty, we've heard it both ways now. Fear of a bubble and the idea, at least in parts of the country, of a hard landing. On the other hand, David LeRae, and admittedly with the National Association of Realtors, who have an interest in this, in the party going on, but saying, hey, we're all right here. The ratio of income to mortgage payments is very healthy, and let's not worry too much about it. He said in the Wall Street Journal, I don't see bubbles bursting. I see bubbles deflating, something that sounds more manageable.
Yeah, but, you know, if you step back from this and just look at this as a demographic issue and a generational issue, consider this. The largest generation, my generation, the baby boom generation, boosted the value of – experienced this great run-up in housing value, such that someone, a friend of mine, who bought a house for $65,000 in Brookline near Boston 20 years ago, it's now worth over $1 million. The question is, what happens when the next generation comes to buy these houses? There has been a quantum leap in their valuation, and how are young people from a standing start, and even if they inherit a house, but if you have two kids or three kids, that's a house split three ways, that's not going to buy you that house in Brookline. I think we're headed for a bigger problem in real estate with this issue of generational transfer.
Ian Morris, have you thought about that issue? It's got a native kind of logic to it. Is there a generational problem looming?
Yes, I think there are some tricky issues there, and in fact, it's the overlapping of generations which can sometimes create cycles, and quite big cycles up and down, as these overlaying generations try to adjust and transfer the stock of housing from one to the other. Certainly, the demographic trends still look favorable over the next 10 to 15 years, generally speaking, for new home sales and new home construction. And America still has a commitment to a strong immigration policy, which will continue, despite September 11 and everything like that. Most of the news we hear is that will still continue.
Which keeps the population growing, even if the baby boom gives way to the baby bust.
Yes, that's right. But again, I really want to stress that most people have forgotten that housing is a cyclical industry, and even if you have positive demographic trends, you can still get periods where rising unemployment just smothers all of those positives for two or three years.
Mm-hmm.
And David earlier was talking about the fact that it's not a bubble because we've got historically low mortgage rates. Yes, we've got the lowest mortgage rates in a generation, but would you really bet on that being sustainable? Probably not. In fact, if they go even lower, it's because the economy is in a lot of trouble.
Let's see what our callers think here, Ian Morris. Lunda's calling from Madison, Wisconsin. Hi, Lunda. You're on the air.
Hello. I had one question, rather fundamental, and then I was requesting a comment. My question is, if you could please define disposable income and give a good idea of what a good ratio of disposable income to a home value would be. And sort of related to that, regarding a bubble effect in the real estate market. In this area, it seems to be occurring more in the higher-end homes, people that can afford to buy the high-priced homes with larger incomes.
Mm-hmm.
There certainly are not a lot of choices for affordably priced houses for people with medium to low-end incomes.
Mm-hmm.
Part of that seems to have to do with zoning rules. They're not building them nowadays.
Mm-hmm. That's not what the builders want to put up.
They're not even allowed to.
Mm-hmm.
I bought a house in 1990 that had 480 square feet.
Mm-hmm.
It's illegal to build a house like that nowadays.
Those are both good questions. Linda, let's put them to Ian Morrison. Thank you for your call. Ian, I guess, first of all, Linda's saying, what's a good multiple of income to home price if you're in the market to buy? And we'll come to our second point later, but just start with that one. What's your advice to a person or a couple who's looking to buy a home? You know, what multiple of their income should it be?
Well, it again varies for different markets because of different supply constraints and all sorts of things. But very roughly, if we were to looking, at the national economy, and again, this is difficult to sort of be able to specify exactly. You're usually looking at 3 to 4 times your gross income. That's the kind of amount that banks are generally happy lending, and typically, right now. It's quite a bit higher than that, and so it's suggestive that especially with lax lending standards, maybe financial conditions are leading people to perhaps take on a little bit too much, particularly with low down payments, if they were to get into trouble later.
And what about this issue of where the bubble lies? Is it in high-end homes? Is it also affecting middle-tier homes? Where are things most lopsided here?
Well, it's certainly true that the top end of town has witnessed the greatest gains. And a lot of that has to do with, of course, the NASDAQ bubble that occurred in the late 90s.
Mm-hmm.
But, of course, as that has collapsed, the $10 million homes have come down in price, but a lot of those people who lived in $10 million homes and can no longer afford them decided to move down to $1 million homes and actually are continuing to push up such prices in some areas up. For example, places like Washington, D.C. are very hot still for the high end, despite what's been going on.
Bailing out of the mega mansion, but raising prices in the regular old mansion.
Exactly, but it is spreading beyond that, and it's spreading to the suburbs and you know, the $200,000 to $500,000 homes as well.
Mm-hmm. Pat's on the line. Welcome, Pat. You're on the air.
Hi, how are you?
Fine, thanks.
I had a question. How does this, in the short term, 1-2 years, and then again slightly longer term, affect the rental markets? Because I'm a renter and probably will be a renter, you know, for the next time being. And I moved from New York to Boston, mm-hmm. and I'm worried about moving back to New York because even after 9/11, the prices just keep creeping up and up and up out of my range.
Right. It's a good question, and thanks for it, Pat. Ian Morse, is there a predictable relationship between housing prices and rental rates? What does it mean in a bubble? What does it mean if we see something of a bust?
Well, usually when rental vacancies go up, the price of rents come down, and usually that's the lead indicator that there'll be some softening in the prices of real estate. Generally, the kind of ludicrous rents that we saw during the bubble years have pretty much gone away. You know, at some point, I remember in the year 2000, brokers were charging 2 months' rent to find you a place to live, and that is no longer happening. In fact, many places around the country, and especially in Manhattan right now, are willing to give you a month's free rent to get you in.
But if you see real estate prices cooling, does that mean maybe some relief to renters as well?
I suspect that is going to be the case.
Let's try and grab one more call. Jeannie's calling from Milwaukee. Hi, Jeannie. You're on the air.
Hi. I just wanted to say that we're a newly married couple, so we're in the real estate market looking for a home. And what I'm seeing is, I sure hope we're in a bubble, actually, because we're looking in rural areas of Wisconsin, and we make a fairly decent income, and we could probably afford some of the homes in the rural areas, but I don't see how anyone who's been living in that area are able to afford any of the homes anymore. They're at least $250,000 for 1 acre and a home on the homes. And
Jeannie, we feel your pain, as a recent president often said. Let me put it to Ian Morse. Thanks for your call, Jeannie. Ian Morse, is there, if the bubble comes down, is that likely to mean homes will be more affordable, or is it likely to be accompanied by a general economic downshift? So even, you know, Jeannie may still have trouble.
Yeah. Again, it depends on the local area. I mean, if she's feeling what she's feeling where she is, and she says she earns a reasonable income, you know, that is flashing a warning signal. Again, I don't want to be overly alarmist here. You know, on a 5-year view, if you choose to live somewhere in this sort of area, it may make sense to pay what seems like a high price right now. Because remember, you still get tax advantages, you know, mortgage interest relief, all that sort of stuff that is a benefit to you.
And as you say, Ian Morris, and as you say, also a place to live. And with that, our time is running down. Ian, thank you so much for joining us tonight. You've been great.
Thank you.
Ian Morris is chief U.S. economist at HSBC Securities in New York. Jack Beatty, everybody worries about that roof over their head, not just to keep the rain off, but these days also for what it means long term for their lives and investment.
Yeah, and what Jeannie was suggesting there is people who grow up in communities can't afford to live there. That's true of not just rural Wisconsin. That's true of our cities. Think of San Francisco. Think of Boston. This is a big thing where the children who grow there can't live there.
The bubble moves people around even if it doesn't burst.
That's right.
Jack, thanks for being with us this hour.
Thank you.
Listeners, you can continue this conversation online. Log on to onpointradio.org and click on forums. In a moment, workers return to rebuilt offices at the Pentagon. This is On Point. About 24 Pentagon employees returned to offices today that were rebuilt after being destroyed in the September 11th terrorist attacks. It was an emotional day for the workers. Many said they felt pride in how quickly the reconstruction took place, but the return to familiar spaces rekindled memories of their 125 colleagues who died there last September. Peter Murphy is the top lawyer for the Marine Corps. In this radio diary, he takes us through the emotions he felt as he returned to his office for the first time since September 11th.
Moving into the exact spot where my office had been destroyed and where I and my staff were caught on September 11th was a whole mixture of emotions. One was the sense of loss that so many people that we knew and many more that we didn't know wouldn't be coming back to the Pentagon because they were killed or because of serious injuries. So there was a real kind of sad element to it. On the other hand, the office spaces were constructed beautifully, high quality, very quickly, I understand, under budget. So there was a sense of dealing with a lot of people with a lot of pride who had helped construct this part of the Pentagon. And the office space was virtually identical to what it looked like on the morning of September 11th before the Flight 77 hit the Pentagon. So it's kind of an eerie feeling on top of everything else. But most importantly, I think it gave me and my office a sense of closure and kind of a feeling that we were forging ahead and weren't going to have somebody else dictate to us where our office was going to be. On September 11th, I was in my office. It was a rather routine morning. I was having a meeting with two of my lawyers. I happened to have the television on, and we saw the first and then the second crash into the World Trade Centers, and we stopped our meeting, obviously, and we're talking about what was going on in New York City and then speculating as to whether something might happen here in Washington. And within a few minutes, an enormous crash occurred. The loudest noise I've ever heard in my life, and we were all tossed across the room, my office, which proceeded to fill up with smoke as a fireball went by the windows. We didn't see the plane come. My back was to the window. We were, as I say, we were tossed across the breadth of my office, but fortunately, we're all unscathed. I think there's some uneasiness. A couple of us had rubbery knees. It appears so peaceful and secure, but of course it did back on September 11th as well. So I think it's safe to say that there was a fair amount of kind of anxiety or nervousness about being back in the exact same space. I mean, I don't think I'm ever going to look out the window in my office and, well, maybe looking for a glint of a sun flashing off an airplane and realize that there are 180 people who were killed and they're in offices right next to ours and right below ours. So that's awfully hard. You know, it's almost like a shrine in a strange sort of way. Because it's not like the World Trade Center Memorial. You know, we're actually back in the exact building in the exact spot that was destroyed.
Peter Murphy is the Marine Corps' top lawyer. Today, he and 21 of his colleagues returned to their Pentagon offices that were destroyed on 9/11. The complete $500 million Pentagon reconstruction project is expected to be finished in time for a memorial service on September 11th. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
This is WBUR. We're funded by